This episode is brought to you by Chiefs on Broadway. There's a different way to experience live music in Nashville. Eric Church's Chiefs on Broadway is home to the Neon Steeple, an intimate live music venue in the heart of downtown Nashville, where artists and songwriters take the stage for up-close, unforgettable shows. From stripped-down sets to surprise guests, no two nights are the same. Check out the Neon Steeple lineup and get your tickets now at chiefsonbroadway.com. It's June. Happy June. We believe there's no time quite like summer to enjoy some country music. BGS is leaning into all things quality country with our sister site, Good Country. This month's edition of Good Country highlights Artist of the Month, Jody Messina, and we have sit-downs with Braxton Keith, the Broody Brothers, and Ashley McBride. Dive in at thebluegrasssituation.com/goodcountry, and thank you for being part of the BGS and Good Country communities.
Hi, and welcome to The Working Songwriter, the show where today's best songwriters come to talk shop. I'm your host, Joe Pug. Each episode here, we host a distinguished guest, and we ask them to go deep on their inspiration, on their process, on the general ups and downs of making a life in music. So, whether you're a grizzled veteran demanding higher billing on a festival marquee, or else a scrappy upstart, simply demanding that the promoter spell your name correctly on your paycheck, this is your show, because ultimately, it is what every writer seeks most, an ironclad excuse to put off actually writing. Hey, everybody. Thanks for being here this week. This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. I'm old enough to remember when you had to pay somebody called a web developer to get a website made. It would always be some guy named Alfie who drove a Mitsubishi Talon with an aftermarket spoiler, and who was always trying to sell you packs of Camel Turkish Golds that were labeled not intended for individual resale. And old Alfie would charge you about $1,000 for a website that would be obsolete in 6 months. But it's the future now. You guys, that's not how it works anymore. We're allowed to have nice things now. One of those nice things is Bandzoogle. For over 20 years, Bandzoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website and online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional single-page electronic press kit in minutes. Everything you need is already built in. Music players, images, text bio, video embeds, a gig calendar, and access to Bandzoogle's award-winning support team 7 days a week. The new EPK plan starts at just $6.95 per month, and the Working Songwriter podcast listeners can go to Bandzoogle.com to try it for free for 30 days. Then use the promo code TWSEPK to get 10% off the first year of any new EPK plan subscription. That's Bandzoogle.com. Promo code TWSEPK. Finally, if you enjoy this podcast, if you'd like to help it remain a viable endeavor for me, here's a couple things that you could do to help. First and foremost, you could become a subscriber to The Vault. The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website that hosts every single episode of The Working Songwriter ever recorded. Additionally, The Vault has every single album I've ever recorded for streaming and for download. Not all of them are on Spotify. There's also an archive of the iconic Enthusiast Digest newsletter there. Go to joepugmusic.com/vault. Become a subscriber today. It's $5 a month for all of that content and for helping this show keep the lights on. Thank you to everybody who's already a subscriber. If you're not in a place where you can contribute in that way, I totally understand. You could still help us out, though, in a couple of ways that are entirely free. First, you could leave us a rating in the iTunes store, or second, you could simply tell a friend about the show. Spread the word about the show. The simple math on those two things is that they will help me much more than they will be a pain in the ass for you. Okay, I'll end all the harassment there. I hope that you enjoy this week's episode.
Thank you.
Our guest this week hails from Harlem, Georgia. Ray Fulcher is one of Nashville's most sought-after modern country songwriters. Fulcher first broke through by co-writing a string of chart-topping hits for Luke Combs, including the multi-platinum When It Rains, It Pours, before stepping into the spotlight with his own recordings with his 2022 debut album, Spray Painted Line. He's toured extensively, sharing stages with Luke Combs, Ashley McBride, and Matt Stell, and his songs have been streamed hundreds of millions of times across all platforms. Fulcher has also written for artists such as Riley Green and Cody Johnson, including Cody's recent hit, The Fall. Billboard highlights his unmistakable narrative grit, while Holler celebrates his clean-cut melodies and lived-in honesty, while Taste of Country notes his ability to turn small-town details into widescreen emotion. I caught up with him on the phone a few weeks ago to hear about his musical journey so far. Ray Fulcher, thanks so much for being a part of the Working Songwriter podcast. We have a fair amount of people come on this show and they say that they're from a small town. Yours might take the cake. Yours is pretty, you know, I had more people in my high school than were in your entire town. Your town is so small that it was not that long ago called, what was it, Sawdust, Georgia?
Yeah, basically. I lived, if you take a right off Sawdust Road and go on County Line Road, that's where I live. But I mean, even today in 2025, I think the whole population is, you know, 2,400, and that's, you know, a good bit more than it was when I was there, you know. So
now you live in, I mean, Nashville at this point is basically a metropolis, and it's growing. So you must really have some perspective on what a kind of unique upbringing that was in America at that time to a certain degree. What do you think you took away from that people growing up in the suburbs or larger cities weren't getting at that time?
Yeah, I mean, it's wild. I didn't really know how sort of, you know, when you're growing up somewhere, you just go, oh, I guess everybody grows up like this or whatever, you know, because you don't have any other perspective. But, you know, what's crazy is it did hit me in Nashville, but you know where it first hit me was when I moved to Athens, Georgia.
Yeah.
And I went to school, you know, and then at the time there was, you know, I think 30,000 something students or whatever. And it was just like culture shock, you know, because there's a ton of people from like Atlanta and bigger cities. And I was like, man, we did not grow up the same way, you know, as we're like interacting and talking and stuff. And, you know, I think that, one of the biggest things is just, you know, when you come from somewhere that small, even if you don't, it sort of just creates this sense of like super tight knit community. Even if you don't know everyone, it feels like you do. And like, me literally just know someone for everything. Like, transmission's messing up, dad knows Bobby, I'm gonna call Bobby and he's going, you know, or whatever. Or it's like, man, killed a deer, I don't have time to address it today. Well, right down the street is the processing plant, you know that guy too. And it's like, I don't know, man, it's just, there's these sense of communities. And what's cool about that, I think, that has like bled into my songwriting is over time, when you're growing up like that, you learn everybody's stories too.
Yeah.
And not just the good parts, but like also the struggles and like the hard parts, you know, and stuff, which is the realness of it, you know. And so that's what I feel like is, and not that people can get that anywhere, but man, when you're from a tiny town like that, it's like you get a little bit of, I think you get a cross section of sort of everybody's ups and downs.
Yeah. And so you said it was real culture shock at first when you went to UGA. I mean, normally we have a strict policy of not having any Georgia Bulldog fans on here because of how obnoxious they can be. But
I wanted to make sure that I inserted that very early on.
You got it in. You're like Bill Simmons talking about the Celtics. You got it in within the first 5 minutes of the pod.
Yeah.
So you go there, you know, there's a kind of a, there's a whole underground scene of music that happened there in Athens, Georgia. Did you notice any of that happening at the 40 Watt Club and stuff like that at the time? Or were you still kind of plugged into, I know you were plugged into sports at the time. Were you plugged into that music scene that was happening in Athens at all?
You know, I didn't get plugged. So I didn't start. I really started, not at first, you know, it was kind of wild. I went there, and then as I'm my freshman and sophomore there, you know, I wasn't playing music yet. And so, but I would hear about, all of a sudden started hearing like, you know, you kind of hear the different areas of like of downtown Athens, which is still not huge compared to some towns, but it's, you know, it's three or four blocks where there's like you know, bars and restaurants and music venues and stuff. And you kind of started to like, I would hear things like, you know, well, down on, you know, at the end of like Washington and stuff, that's where the 40 Watt Club and that's where, you know, Max Canada, and that's where like 40, Georgia Theater is and all that stuff. And it's like, that's like where the music scene is. And I'm like, music scene. And then I kind of did my own research and was like, oh, it's like, man, Widespread Panic and the B-52s and like all this stuff.
R.E.M., all that. Yeah.
And then started learning about, or then I started seeing, man, look at all these people coming through Georgia Theater.
Yeah.
And I mean, that ended up being like the first time, and really where, even though I loved music growing up, really where the kind of like the seed got planted for me of being inspired was at those places in Athens that I didn't even know existed before, but Georgia Theater specifically, it was the first time that I saw, I mean, I would see Corey Smith get up there, just him and another guitar player. And he would just like, I mean, it just mesmerized me what he was doing. And like the songs were just speaking to me. And I was like, man, this is so cool. This is different. Like, man, they're speaking, songs are speaking right to me. The first time I got to see early days of like Al Dean and Luke Bryan and stuff. But the one that really, I think, put me over the edge as far as like, man, I'm so inspired by this. This is like, can't be coincidence. I have to do something about this now, which is get a guitar, learn it, like see where this path leads, is the first time I saw Eric Church there early on. I mean, 2006, 2007, didn't even know who, I mean, I had some friends come up from that, from home, and they were like, you know, they were big fans of his album just come out, and they were fans. He had his first single out called How About You on the radio. Hadn't heard of this guy. At the time, I was so, you know, so busy with doing football stuff and all. And so, not playing, but as you said, on staff there as a student assistant. And so, and I really didn't want to go because I'm like, it's kind of that thing where it's like, man, I don't know this guy. I'm not going to know any of the songs. You know, and you're 20 years old or whatever it is, 21. And so, but they got me down there. And I remember from the jump, I was like, whoa, his live band show was just like awesome, and these songs were like a little bit different than anything I'd heard before.
Yeah.
And there was like this country lyric, but it was just this driving rock thing. And then he sent the band off stage and he like sings this song called Lightning about this guy that, you know, he puts himself first person perspective, you know, a guy on death row, and like all of the, just the really the journey of his like psychology through the whole process and stuff. And like, you know, literally just like what's going through this guy's head as he's like walking to the gallows. And I'm like, man, what is this? This is so cool.
Yeah.
And it's like, is, and as much as I will always say Eric Church and George Strait are my like top two. Right. And George Strait is, to me, he's the king, he's whatever. And you know, and Dean Dillon and some, a lot of guys had a big part of that. And those songs are incredible. But the stuff Eric was doing was so different.
Yeah.
And like, that's what really hooked me as far, it turned it from that night is the, I would say the seminal moment where I was like, music didn't just become something I loved. It became something that I wanted to like do.
But you know, what strikes me as strange is, you know, you get to, a lot of people who are at that concert, you get to see Eric Church at that point in his arc. I mean, it had to inspire a lot of people. Obviously, you know, he'd go on to Phillips Stadium two decades later. But, I mean, so a lot of people were inspired by it. It seems kind of crazy, though, that you go from guy like on football staff, sees a concert that lights him on fire. And it seems kind of crazy that you'd be like, well, I think I can do that and just go for it from there. Like, what do you think that, was there any like intimation of that before? Or this really was out of the blue?
Well, I just knew that like, that it was a little bit different for me because I do remember looking around in that moment and I've got chills all over my body. Like when I'm standing there listening to this song, like almost tearing up, and it's like people were digging it, but they were still kind of like chatting with their friends and they were still, and I was like, oh, this is a different experience for me.
Yes.
But also I knew that I had never felt anything like that before since. And so I was like, okay, well, this can't be a coincidence. And so I'm like doing myself a disservice if I at least don't like explore this a little bit, because I had never felt anything, a moment like that, that almost over the light bulb went off and was like, oh, this is what life's about. You know what I mean? Yeah. This is what you're like, this is what a calling is supposed to feel like, whether this is mine or not. I know that this is, there's no denying that this is what that feels like.
Yeah.
So
the song that did that for me, my dad played me John Prine's first record when I was in high school. And when I heard Sam Stone, very similar feeling to what you're talking about there. I didn't know. I just didn't. I wasn't aware that songs could do that, that could be that detailed and could take you. I just wasn't aware that that was an availability.
100%.
You know?
Yeah.
So from there, I mean, obviously it doesn't just go, you're standing in Georgia Theater and 2 days later you're in Nashville making a go of it. I mean, you had a bunch of jobs. You know, that record of your spray painted line, I feel like you kind of go over every damn job that you did before you got there. Kind of describe to me this period, because I think a lot of listeners to this show might be in this period themselves. Describe that period where you're kind of like muddling through before you make the decision to go to Nashville, before you...
Oh, man. It was... I mean, up and down. And so I'll say this, between the time I saw Eric and the time I moved to Nashville was 7 years.
Wow.
So it was a long gap. Wow. And so, I mean, the first step for me was like, you know, it kind of became one of these things. And I didn't have any, like, let me say this first. I didn't have any of these that night and even the weeks following. I didn't have any grand sort of thoughts of like, oh, man, I could do this for a living. It was just like little bitty things that kind of like, tiny little goals, right? It was like, it made me go, well, man, I want to like, and maybe by that time, I think I may have like bought a guitar, but like never messed with it. You know, it was just kind of like something cool to have in the house or whatever. But it was like, okay, now I'm going to learn guitar. I'm going to find some songs that I want to play, even if it's three chords, like to get through or whatever. And then it was, well, man, you know, if I can learn a couple songs, maybe I can learn more chords. And then it was, oh, it'd be cool to try to, you know, maybe write a song. And then it was, you know, man, how cool would it be to like do an open mic night? Probably wouldn't ever play a show, but maybe an open mic night. And then you do that and you're like, man, I bet there's a, you know, a Mexican restaurant that would let me play in the corner somewhere or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And, cause that happens a lot in Athens and other places. And so, and then next thing you know, you meet a couple guys that are playing guitar too. And I remember it was after I worked for the football team. It was after our spring game. And I think probably 2007 or eight, one of those 2 years, it was like, I worked all day with the football team. And then I had my first gig at a place called Calientitos, which is a Cuban restaurant.
Nice.
Right there beside the football complex. And literally just like all covers, scared to death.
Yes.
Scared to death.
Yeah.
And me and my friend Tyler Morgan, who ended up being in a band with me in college. And it was kind of went from there, right? It was like tiny little goals. And even then I went through graduate school at Georgia and kind of, you know, found some bars to play at in Athens on the weekends and when I could, or Thursday nights. But even when I moved back home after college, but that whole time I was like, well, this is a really cool story I get to tell my kids, man.
Yeah.
Dad played, you know, gigs in college. It's pretty cool. You know,
yeah.
And it was like, okay, but now you got a master's degree. You need to turn the page on your life.
Yeah.
But then a weird thing in history kind of happened at the same time. So for the first time in 50 years, when I graduated, I was going to school to be a teacher and a coach. And for the first time in like 50 years, there was like a teaching job shortage in the state of Georgia. And so
not that they were short of teachers, but they had a surplus of teachers,
a shortage of like jobs. Openings.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And so here I was with a master's in it and really like no job offers other than just like almost like, you know, part-time in this subject that I hadn't like had anything. And I just was, you know, man, like what in the world? So I was like, you know what? I'm not going to take that job. I'm going to at least wait until I can get something in the field that I studied for. Mm-hmm. And so it talks about this in spray painting line, but I went and just looked at the newspapers and like, all right, I got to find something to bridge the gap, pay some bills. So I saw a little, you know, blurb or article about there being a job at Gerald Jones Volvo Subaru, which I'd never sold anything in my life, but it was for a car salesman.
Yeah.
And I went in, and the guy that I interviewed with ended up is now still today one of my best friends. But it just was this thing where I was like, man, this guy's cool. He gets that I don't know, you know, what I'm doing necessarily as far as selling. But what he did like is that I had a degree, which told him he can learn, you know, he's got the ability to learn. So I went in there, and for the next year, I sold cars. And but it was crazy. You know, what I found there is that, like, every day I'll go and work. And even if I was making decent money, or like, even if, you know, and I actually got to where I was interested in, like, the process of, like, sales and the cars and, like, you know, whatever, there's art to that too. But I realized that every single day I was there, all I was thinking about was writing songs and, like, being on stage. And what is this second verse going to be like for this, you know, idea? So that was the pervasive thoughts. And so then I did a couple other jobs and ended up selling gym memberships. And at this time, I realized, I was like, maybe this can't be a thing that I put, just totally put down, but maybe it's like, all right, here in my hometown, I can play some shows. So formed a band there, met a guy, but have known him for a while, but formed a band with a great friend of mine named Alex Hintz from back home in Harlem. And a guy who is still to this day my drummer named Tyson Thaxton. He was from that area. And we just started playing on, we got this, like, every Thursday night we played at this one spot in Augusta. But even then it was like, well, when the right job comes along, this will go away. And man, and I remember that I always had dreams of moving to Nashville, but I had this life built there. I had a girlfriend there. My whole family was there. I have a master's degree. It's like, you can't just, and I mean, you have to be insane to, like, put all that away. And then, man, and the longer it went, the longer I was playing those shows, and the more that, no matter what job I did, the more I realized that, like, that wasn't going away. I still was, that's all I was thinking about every day was, like, songs. And this just dream of, like, man, how far can this go? Is this really the end? And so, I mean, literally for, and then one day I was like, you know what? I'm going to do it. And for a year, I'm going to move to Nashville. I'm going to try it. And the moment for me that made that decision was, I was, because I kind of, during this year of going, like, man, I think I might move to Nashville, I kept changing my mind so much. And I literally was like, I had to simplify it for myself. And I simplified it to one question. And it was like a what if question for me. Okay, can I wake up at 50 years old, 60 years old, whatever, and be okay with, like, never trying and not knowing? Because if I can be okay with that, then, like, I'm not going to go. And the answer immediately was like, no. Like, I will never forgive myself if I don't do it. And I just kind of knew that in my heart. And so then it was, like I said, several months of kind of deciding when, and then, man, am I really going to do this? And, you know, decide, you know, when to talk to the people that need to be talked about, and my family and my girlfriend at the time. Hard conversations, right? And so, and one of the biggest conversations for me was, there was my high school football coach is a guy who's still one of my dad's best friends. And we talk all the time still. He's a legend in Harlem. He's like, won 7 or 8 state titles at Harlem. He's, you know, the second winningest coach in Georgia history. He's a legend there. And so this whole time it was like, when I do get a job, I want it to be at Harlem and I want to coach with Coach Lewis. And then, like, that was going to be the thing. And so, and I really didn't want to let him down. And so I went and had a conversation with him one day, and I was real scared to have it, cause I was just scared. I told him what I thought I was going to do. I thought he was going to be like, well, that's crazy. You know, you need to stay here. I'm like, no, I need you, whatever.
Yeah.
And I told him, you know, what I was thinking about, and I'll never forget it. And to this day, we still say this, and I probably just need to put it on the hat or something, because I say it all the time.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget, he said to me, he goes, well, after I told him what was sort of on my heart and, like, why I wanted to move, and I explained it to him, he goes, well, the way I figure it is, you can't hit a home run unless you swing the bat. So if I were you, I think I'd have to swing the bat.
Yeah.
And, like, and that was literally just, like, all I needed to hear to go, oh, it's not going to, like, it's okay if I make this decision for myself and go do it. And so, you know, and then it was May of 2014.
You know what's crazy about that moment with your coach, just to pause on that, is it almost seems like the younger you went into his office wanting him, in a way, wanting him to tell you, no, I need you here. No, we were meant to. Like, there's a part of you, because that would have given you a permission structure to not try it. So there, it's almost like there was this part of you wanting him to not say what he said, you know?
Yeah. I mean, for sure. It was like the part that's scared to death of like failing and scared to death of moving and not knowing anybody. Yeah, that part of me was like, if he just tells me how stupid this is, maybe I'll kind of go, I'll snap back into reality.
Right,
you know?
Right. But he didn't.
But he didn't do that.
Yeah.
He didn't do that.
Yeah.
And then sort of once you make that commitment to have that conversation, then it's like even more of a reason to like,
yeah.
You got, and I promised myself, I remember saying if I, and I, cause I moved to town a little bit later in life. And I remember promising myself, if I don't, like, I have to move by my 29th birthday. Like, that's my mm-hmm. cutoff. If I don't do it, like, I just had to make that, you know, just to make myself set the date, set the time so that fear didn't hold me back. And 3 days before my 29th birthday, May 12th, 2014, moved to Nashville,
yeah.
Didn't know a soul and, didn't really know what I was doing, but knew that it had come to a point where there was not a, it was no longer a decision. I had to do it.
Ray had to move from hearth and home in Georgia to make his musical dream come true. It sounds like he came from a pretty tight-knit community back there, and it also sounds like he had an expected life path that it would have been perfectly reasonable for him to take. And yet, he took the leap anyway. Many artists have to take that step away from the familiar to chase their star. I had to do it myself in my early 20s, and it's worth it, but there's also a trade-off. There's a poem by one of the poet laureates of Georgia, David Bottoms, about that trade-off entitled Barriers. When thunder woke me to the early dark, I lay awake listening to the pines whip the house, and remembered a story a woman once told me of her childhood in California, how storms off the Pacific would wake her at night, frighten her into her parents' room. Such comfort and warmth, she said, in those drowsy voices that, crawling under the covers into her private dark. Sometimes she slept beside her mother, sometimes her father. How they must have loved her, she said, though they never let her sleep between them. I am not a father, but I think about the love of fathers, the sheet thrown back for the daughter, the rough hand rejoining the hand of the mother. And because of her story, I know more about the love a man can feel for a woman. Love not born of the self or what the self gives the world. These nights alone, when the country lies between us like a curse, I like to picture lightning flaring through the curtains of a bedroom, a young girl standing at the foot of a bed. I try to imagine in the white spark of the window the small angel her father saw, her white gown, the pure light of her heart, and write in my letters how love fears even the barrier of a blessing. So what was it like moving there? So you mentioned 29, which would not, in most lines of work, not be an advanced age to move right. to a town, right? But in Nashville, a lot of people move there much younger than that. Like,
yeah.
So what did you find? What did it feel like to be a rookie there, you know, but in kind of an older age cohort than most of the people who were starting out?
You know, looking back, I think it helped me because I think back and I go, man, if I was 24, 25 in Nashville, I never would have, like, I didn't have, number one, I don't think I had the chops in the last.
Sure.
But number two, I just don't think mentally mature wise, like, I would have been able to undertake the grind that, or not even the grind, but just like the grind of 99 no's, maybe one yes, you know, just like kind of, really to be able to take in the process and understand what was going on, because I didn't grow up in music and I didn't like, I hadn't been working on this my whole life. So I had still had a lot of improving to do, even improving in, even when I was 29, but definitely 23, 24, I never would have lasted. So, you know, what I think it did for me and that helped me is because I remember going, well, if I'm the only, if no one's ever made it, truly made it in music and never really started until they were 29, If there's never been anyone that does that, well, there's got to be a first, number one. But then also it made me sort of go, well, I'm a little bit behind, so I need to work doubly hard. And so it made me on the, like, on the Tuesday night when I had written for free all day and worked my part-time job, and there was a songwriter round going on, and that maybe there was some networking I could do there. Well, instead of going home, even if I was tired, I would go there, because I was trying to, like, always sort of put the extra little bit in to sort of make up for this lost time, at least in my mind. And so I think it made me stay more locked in. Coming at a later age, I just was like laser focused, because I knew that in some way I was moving a little bit later than most. And so I had to close that gap a little bit. And my way of doing that was just maybe trying to outwork people, trying to outfocus people, trying to outfigure out people, you know? So, and really that's more of a me versus me. Okay. You can't control them, you can control you. Let's put as much effort as we can to sort of, like, catch back up. So
you mentioned that even at 29, there was a lot that you had to get up to speed with writing and technique-wise. Can you speak to both? What were you not doing well that you had to get better at? And then paired with that is who helped teach you?
So I really didn't understand. I had never co-wrote really before I moved to Nashville. And so that was, you know, the things I had to learn was how to, number one, how important the structure was, how important the, like, just the melody was, and the understanding of, like, what is a hook? And sometimes it's a melody, sometimes it's the end of a chorus. It's sometimes like, okay, well, to write a great song or even a good one, it's got to have something that grabs the listener, something they can resonate with, and understanding what those things are and how they can be different. And, you know, the biggest thing I had to learn was stamina, right? If you're going to be a songwriter for a living, it's like, I remember I would write, like, it literally would match me trying to write a song in a day with someone or two people. It would take every ounce of energy out of me. And I was so exhausted afterwards. And that would be like, maybe two or three songs in a week. And it's like, but if you're a professional, it's like, I mean, and just what you're doing every day, I had to learn how to, and this came with just repetitions. It's no different than going to the gym every day. It's like you get stronger, you get adapted to it. But I had another thing that I had to learn was how to write a great song without being inspired, because it's like impossible for the human mind and heart to be just like over the top inspired every day. But it's like, you're still writing every day. If you're on Music Row, especially when it's your job to do it, it's like, you got to find that way to, at least I had to find that way to be super creative and find a way to write a great song and push through the sort of like, almost not even writer's block, but just sort of the blasé of like, man, it's been a long week and I've written three or four songs this week. How can I be creative today when it's like, I really want my brain to, it feels like it needs to unplug. And it was like, and I had to learn how to like push through that barrier, because what I found is once I found that great idea, or once the hook hits you, or once the melody comes, all of a sudden it's like, boom, you get inspired. And that's the magic. It's like, you may walk into the room uninspired, but it was like, I had to learn how to be okay with that until it came to me within each individual write. So,
do you remember when you started to kind of develop your own style? When I think of your style of writing, which is interesting because now a lot of country writing sounds like this, but I think it's because of how influential some of your songs have been. It's when I think of your writing, there's more than most. There's a lot of internal rhymes. There's a lot of like the meter will change even within a verse, and it certainly changes big time between like a pre-chorus and a chorus and a bridge.
Yeah.
Had that kind of style always been a part of you, or was that something that you had to develop over time?
You know, I think that thing you're talking about, I think for whatever reason, it's like, came naturally to me. I just heard it in that way. And then also the things that made sense to me that I've always loved writing were taking like taking a phrase or taking a word and having the different verses mean different things, but it all like, but then the chorus all point back to like this one big feeling. And I always, for whatever reason, loved those things and gravitate to those type of ideas. And cause I always had this yearning of like wanting to tell a story. And for me, those ways of writing songs were able to tell a story without going, well, one day Bobby was, without actually telling a story by sounding like you're just talking, you know? And so, whether that's a coming of age song or whether it's, you know, different stuff, like, and a lot of that stuff I wrote with Luke Combs in the early days was like, was that, if you go back to his first, second record, a lot of that stuff was those kind of, were those kind of things, or these like phrases that people say all the time, and then taking that and making it mean something that doesn't mean in everyday life. Like, when it rains, it pours, for instance, right? It's like, people say it all the time, but in that context of that song, it was, we just sort of like made it a really good thing. And it's like finding those little ways to flip. I enjoy doing that kind of thing. So
that's what's so funny about that song is 99 times out of 100, if that song with that kind of common phrase was written in Nashville, it'd be the sad song. So you brought it up, and I just got to ask you, you've probably told the story a million times, but that was the first song. I mean, that song's certified diamond now, but that was the first song that really broke for you and Luke Combs, right?
Yeah. So we
did, what did that feel like? Song we,
man, it was, I'll tell you what, it was crazy. I mean, the first song we ever wrote was with our buddy James McNair, a song that was on his first album, a song called Beer Can. Nothing picks me up like a beer can, you know, and the double meaning thing or whatever. And, but it was not long after that we wrote, I mean, it was 2015. We wrote When It Rains, It Pours. And I just remember, you know, it's crazy. And I try to remember this every day as I'm going into writes and stuff, that you just like never know what the magic or where it's going to come from or whatever. Cause we wrote When It Rains, It Pours. And I remember we had a blast writing it, me, Luke, and Jordan Walker. But I walked out that day not going, because, I mean, we didn't have anything to make us think it would be what it is today, because at the time, Luke didn't have a record deal yet. None of us had publishing deals yet. And so there's really no avenue for that song to be big at the time. And I just remember going, man, we had a blast writing that. We laughed a lot, whatever. But no inkling in my mind would ever think that what happened with that song would happen. But then the next thing you know, it's like Luke gets a record deal and Hurricane goes to radio. And I think as it's like the week it's going number one, we're down in Key West for the Key West Songwriters Festival in 2017. I think it is 2017. And yeah, because Hurricane had went to radio in 16. So we're down there, and or it's in the top five at least. And Luke had a bunch of radio people come and sort of to Key West that were going to be down there, and he was going to play in the first album. And I remember that nobody had really talked about what a second single was going to be or any of that stuff yet. And in my mind, I'm still like, man, I'm just hoping to get a couple songs on the record. Man, this is so fun. Like, man, one of my best buddies is getting a record deal, man. This is awesome. And then apparently, so he played the record for the radio people. And then afterwards, I met up with him after the meeting, and he goes, dude, he's played him the whole record. He's like, dude, the one that they can't quit talking about is When It Rains, It Pours. And I go, for real? I was like, that quirky, funny song or whatever? And he's like, dude, we played it, and there's people, I mean, these guys, like, were putting their hand, like, on the table going, like, we'll play that tomorrow. Like, we need it tomorrow. And I'm like, damn. You're messing with me, right? And he's like, no, I'm not. And so then it becomes a second single, and it's a big number one. And now it's like, I think 12 times platinum. And it's like, I mean, who in the world would have ever thought that, you know? And so,
well, not only that, like how much it sold, but it has established itself like within that song is now like in the canon of American music, like with any of George Strait's number ones, like it's kind of beyond a number one. It's kind of like a cultural phenomenon, man. And like, that's, yeah. I always joke around that, like, you know, the dream as the songwriter is to write Amazing Grace, right? Like, you want to just write that song that just becomes, weaved within the fabric of a culture. And I'm not saying that when it rains, it pours, yeah, is amazing grace, but it has tasted like that level of just being woven into culture in a way that is, it's beyond a dream. It's beyond a dream, man.
Man, I think, and looking back, and I appreciate you saying that, man, and it is, it's beyond, like, I could have never imagined in a million years, like, you know, that I'd write a song that is done without it's done. And looking back, I think it was like, man, it was so against the grain of what was popular in country music at the time. And it was just had this like throwback 90s right in your face, was very unapologetic about what it was saying, which is like when we wrote it, we had no reason to follow any rules. Right. And that ended up being the reason that it did what it did, is because it's like this, it was like this sort of thing out of left field from what was happening at the time, that looking back, it was like, that's the thing that ended up making it special. You know, which I also try to remember too, where it's like, whatever's going on now will not be the deal in a couple of years or whatever. And so, you know, and it's like, well, just be you, because you can't go chasing, you know, like bring some TLC. You can't go chasing waterfall. Just be yourself and like, let that take you where it's going to take you. So is where the conversation I have with myself a lot.
Yeah. 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 I mean, you were describing it first coming to town and being like, I'm going to control what I can control. And that's great.
Yeah.
And you have to, there's no ticket to the dance without controlling what you can control. But yeah, outside of that, sometimes, you know, there's bigger forces at play. The zeitgeist is at play. Providence is at play. And you just don't know.
Yeah.
Just don't know, man.
Yeah.
So you write all the time. You've written with everyone in Nashville. I'm always interested. One of the things I like the most, like when I'm reading about a football team or a baseball team, I'm always interested in, there's always a player on the team who's good, but the other players on the team speak of the guy with reverence, like in a way about their talent in a way that you almost wouldn't expect. I'm thinking of like J.R. Smith back in the day, who was kind of a screw up, but apparently he was the guy that would always be picked in pickup games. So who in all your writing, all these different rooms that you've been in, who can you name one or two people that you just like, that person has the most jump out of the gym talent that I've ever seen in my life? It's insane.
Oh my gosh. Well, Jonathan Singleton comes to mind first. Written a bunch with him. He's produced my records and stuff. The guy's just like, the melodies he comes up with, the guitar playing, the just like put on this earth to write songs and great songs and put on this earth to sing them, you know? And so he had a record deal back in the day, but like, you know, he got married and had kids and stuff and like ended up being a songwriter and has been, you know, unbelievably successful, but just pure talent. It's like the guy's unreal, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think about him, and there's so many guys that are like, just so, you know, daggum talented, you know. Another, guy I think about a lot, and we get to write a good bit that I think that is going to go on a run here soon. And he's had a couple number ones as an artist and a couple as a writer too. But every time we write, and I think, you know, in a lot of ways we came with the same upbringing, but I love his voice and I love how hard he works, but I also love just like, man, the guy's just such a talent with like melodies and ideas. Is Jameson Rogers is another guy that I think is The guy's great, and we're really great friends. And so, when he hears this, I'll get some good friend points too.
Good,
but
good, good.
Yeah.
Have you beaten him in golf yet?
What's that?
Have you beaten him in golf yet?
You know what I did?
I
went a long time without beating him, and in the greatest place to do it on earth,
good,
in Pinehurst, North Carolina, I did it.
Damn, there you go.
And we've actually written with Jameson, you know, me and you have written together with Jameson. And so you got to see some of that of what I'm talking about.
Wow. I mean, wow. Yeah. So my deal is I kind of play like more, you know, kind of indie music. I do my own thing. Mm-hmm. And, Matt Stell was nice enough to bring me in, to write with you guys once. And I've been on such a personal creative tear ever since working, with you guys, just to see how fast everyone is, how, like the level that I feel like I got to step into a league and you're like, okay, this is where the bar is set. And It's funny, man. I think sometimes in life when you see that, you can get discouraged by it in some ways, or you can get really inspired by it. And I just got really, really inspired by the level of work. And just to think that every day while I'm here home in Maryland, like there's people getting together in rooms like that and banging stuff out. Like there's just, it seems like there's a special thing happening in Nashville. Perhaps there always has been, but it seems like it's in a really good place right now.
Man, I would agree with you. And first of all, thanks for writing with us, man. Oh, we wrote a great song.
My pleasure.
I love it. I love that song.
And
but there is, man, golly, it's like, it feels like more now than ever, you know, every day on Music Row, it feels like, man, more than ever, people care about these songs and care about like what they say and care about affecting people in positive ways, whether it's giving them something to grab a hold to when they're going through a tough time, or whether it's, I mean, it's like the songs matter so much to us. And I feel that now in these rooms now more than I ever have.
Yep.
So I think you're right, you know, to say that.
And even there's some really interesting things happening. I'm noticing more and more with songs that, like, if I just turn on Spotify and I jump on, you know, the Hot Country playlist, like when you listen to the production of the songs, there's also a lot of strange new kind of like rock and indie influences. I think of, like, if you look at like the lineup of Morgan Wallen's festival, it's like War on Drugs is playing there. You know what I mean? And there's starting to be a weird new amalgam of music. I feel like mainstream country is starting to be like this lodestar that is starting to bring in all these disparate influences right now to make it more. It seemed like when I was a kid in the 90s, mainstream country was its own thing. Like you were a person that listened to that.
Yeah.
And now mainstream country is just mainstream music. It's a really big change from 30 years ago.
Yeah, there's so many different elements and different kind of corners of the room, right?
Yep.
And that's what's, man, it's pretty awesome too, because it's like, man, it gives you this freedom to kind of go to be your most authentic self, right? Because you go, you know, there has been times before where you go, man, I really kind of want to write this song about this dude sitting in jail because of whatever. And then there was a time where you go, you know, because that's real to a lot of people, and like, that, you know, man, write this story that you just come up with. And for a long time, you're like, well, I could do that, but I'm going to have to put it out because no one's going to cut that kind of thing. But now it's like you can, it feels like it's more open than ever to like just be you and say the things you want to do. There's going to be someone out there that's going to love it. An artist is going to love it. And if not, you get to put it out. And now because of, you know, and that's cool because you don't have to even have a record deal now to like to grow a fan base and to keep that thing going. And so it's just like, man, write what, you know, it's like for me, it's given me like myself permission to just like, man, write the stuff that sets me on fire. Whether it's if today it's something that, you know, may not have ever got cut before and maybe it won't now, but it's like I can still put it out. I still continue to do my own thing without even pursuing a record deal. I had one for a couple of years, and that was awesome. I would never take that away. But now it's like, man, you can kind of – it's open to do it however you want, which is awesome.
Yeah. So it's funny. The reason I got a hold of you this summer, I've wanted to do a chat like this with you for a while, but I noticed this summer that it seemed like you were starting to lean back in to your own artist career a bit. Can you kind of talk about what you have coming up on the horizon right now and how you've been approaching that?
Yeah. So I recorded a second album before I walked away from Black River and one of those guys over there, it was just time. Right.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
I had a second album recorded and then I just was like, you know what? Now we just kind of do it how we want. And so I've released some of those things with really no, I mean, kind of, I love Jonathan and I and Neil Mason, my manager, Jonathan Singleton produces. And I think we're at our best when we can kind of just sort of use our imagination and do it, you know, however we want, make it sound however we want, put it out when we want kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I had that album. I put out some of those songs. I still have about half of them to go and I'm going to start there. And, you know, later this year, next year. But then I also had this little folder in my phone where I go, if someone else, bigger artist wants to cut it, great. But like, here's a list of songs that I've want to cut and put out because they mean a lot to me, and I think they'll mean a lot to people. And so I'm going to keep doing that, and I'm going to keep, you know, it's, I'm playing a lot of songwriter shows right now, really all across the country, but there's going to come a time next year where we'll pick some markets and go play with the band again and play this new stuff we're putting out, you know, and because I love recording music and putting it out. I love writing, recording and putting it out. And we're in a time now where you can do that and you don't necessarily have to pursue terrestrial radio to be number one, successful, but number two, to reach people and affect people. And it's, and that's why I got into the business in the first place is to do that, to hopefully make someone feel like I felt that night. And you don't have to have a record deal to do that. And so that's why I'm going to keep doing my thing and setting my, and what's cool too, is to give me permission to sort of do those things, right? Where it's like, I don't have to think about, man, could this work on radio? I don't have to think about that. I just go, yo, I love the song. Does it speak to me? Well, let's put it out. Cause there's gotta be someone else out there too that it speaks to.
I think a good way to put a button on this interview is, you know, I wonder a lot. We talked earlier about that big decision you made. You wanted to leave before you were 29, something that you went through with your family and discussed with them. You went through and talked to that coach that was so important to you. Can you speak a little bit to what their experience has been to see you leave like that on this kind of, I mean, pretty kind of Don Quixote like journey that seems crazy.
Yeah.
And then like, when was the moment that you feel like your folks or the people closest to you could realize what had happened? Was there like a single moment when they realized like, dang, it worked?
I feel, yeah, I think so. And, you know, for me, I'll say without my mom and dad's support, and really my sister, just my family in general and my friends, I didn't have one person, as crazy as it was. And I, like you said, I probably was in a way looking for the one person.
Right, exactly.
But I never had one person that said, dude, you're so stupid for doing this. And like, that's sort of what I expected because it was so crazy. And, but my really close knit friends and my whole family, they, even if they had their doubts, which I'm sure that they had to have because I did too. They supported me and was like, if this is in your heart, you want to do it, go do it. But if you're going to do it 100%, go all in on it. And even those first couple of years in Nashville where it was like, I mean, we didn't know if anything would ever happen. I mean, you know, super short on money. Like, and you just don't know what's coming in the future, but you're just working and hoping. They were supporting me through that whole thing. And you know, what's funny is I don't know that, I think they got it, but they didn't really get it until like I had a couple number ones, maybe even three at the time. But the first time that I got a record deal and I got invited to play the Grand Ole Opry, and they came and saw me play the Opry. And to, you know, to small town folks and a lot of people, Grand Ole Opry is like the Holy Grail, right? And even, and to me too, that was like one of my huge bucket list items, like maybe even at the top, was to play the Grand Ole Opry. And when they came and saw me play the Opry, and I played the song Selling Cars, and at the end, it was the first time I'd ever played it. And maybe my most favorite moment in music yet is I played that song by myself, got a standing ovation at the Grand Ole Opry. And it was like, it felt like after that moment is when they were like, oh, it really happened. You know, like you did it, you know, or whatever. And so even though we're never at a destination on the journey, as you were saying, like, oh, it, man, you've done what you set out to accomplish when you moved, and we're so proud of you. It felt like, even though those great things had happened, that was the night where it really clicked for him, I think.
Well, dude, that is a night like that. Also, that's kind of like a freeing moment as an artist too, because that really is a moment where it's like, dude, it could all dry up tomorrow. No one gets to take, I did that, man. No one gets to take that moment away from me. I did it.
Yep.
It's in the bank. Can't take it away. I mean, that, you know, you're playing with house money after that, man. That's.
Yeah, it was, and I've always said, man, like, you know, if yesterday was the last song I ever write, I've been so blessed, and I've gotten to experience things that I never would have dreamed I would have. And I've accomplished things I never, ever in my wildest dreams would have thought was even possible. And And I try to remind myself of that sometimes, that like, man, hey, quit being so hard on yourself all the time, because you got a lot to be proud of and you got a lot to be thankful for, even if you don't do anything else. And so the competitor in me, the same work ethic that sort of got me those things, is still in me and still what drives me every day. And so there's that balance of that, and also what you were saying, sort of like, man, you're sort of playing with house money because we're at a spot we never thought we'd be at in the first place anyway, which is very freeing and something I'm extremely thankful for and don't take that for granted at all.
Well, dude, so happy and so grateful that you came on the show. Thanks so much for being a part of the Working Songwriter Podcast.
Joe, you're the man. Thank you so much for having me.
This week's show was brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. Use promo code TWS, the initials of our podcast, TWS, to get 15% off the first year of any new subscription. Ray Fulcher's latest single is entitled Long Night in Lynchburg, available everywhere music is sold or streamed. If before we meet again, you sit down to write, please remember, an expensive drug habit is not a song, a compelling Instagram account is not a song, and most importantly, reverb is not a song. So let all that take care of itself, and for you, just keep your eye on the song.